This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Nanotechnology in the American Super Soldier, a presentation by historian and anthropologist of science, Laurel Breitman. It took place on July 22, 2009.
This talk comes out of, I was trying to get to my graduate student office at MIT about 3 years ago, and I'm a social scientist there, and they put us in the basement of the business school, and it's hard to get to our offices on a good day. The scientists tend to get the best space, but I was barred from getting to my office. I was told that there was a four-star general visiting the building, and then I had to go around the other way, and I had to wait. And I began to get curious about what on earth a four-star general was doing in my building. Coming to MIT, I was conflicted. I knew the Department of Defense funded a lot of research that happens there. I knew that even if I was coming in on external grant money, that the institution that where I was at was going to be profiting from these sorts of relationships. I wasn't sure how I felt about it, but I wanted to learn more. In any case, I started looking into what was going on, why these generals were continuing to visit, and the reason was something called the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology. It was founded in 2002, and the mission of the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology is to create a battlesuit of the future. MIT partnered with the US Army, Raytheon, DuPont, and a number of other military industrial contractors in 2002 in order to create this battlesuit. And the battlesuit's interesting. It's supposed to be the width and flexibility of spandex. It's supposed to recognize chemical and biological weapons and then deliver an antidote. They think through ultrasound, or they're still trying to figure that out. It's supposed to be selectively bulletproof, meaning that it should be very, very fluid. The problem with Kevlar right now is that it's very heavy and it's very stiff. So it's bulletproof, but particularly if you're somewhere like Iraq or Afghanistan, it's very hot and it's very heavy. So the Army for a long time has been looking for alternatives. So the idea with this is that you would have a very, very flexible fabric. In fact, that it would be woven of fluids. And that it would also be electric conductive. And so that using electricity, you could selectively stiffen parts of the suit. And they're envisioning it happening at light speed. So the soldier wouldn't actually have to do anything. As soon as this battle suit sensed a bullet, it would stiffen and block the bullet. It's also supposed to monitor the wearer's vital signs, so pulse and temperature, and then respond accordingly. If the suit was conductive, it would also be able to heat selectively. So the example they gave me was that if you were a soldier and you fell asleep with your leg outside of your sleeping bag, you could reheat it. You know, I immediately asked, well, who falls asleep with a leg outside of their sleeping bag? But, you know, you never know. And it's also, if something happens to the soldier, able to communicate vital signs from the soldier to other suits nearby, not even other soldiers, and also remotely. So they're looking at a huge, huge array of capabilities to come out of the suit. This started in 2002, and very few of these are actually possible, although they're working towards them. A lot of this is about funding basic research. So MIT got $25 million to start this project. And I'll spend a little bit of time talking about some of the general parts of the suit, but I want to talk about, in most detail, the ability of the suit to give the soldier of the future the ability to smell explosives as well as a bomb-trained dog. That's actually not visible in this schematic because it ended up not being part of the suit itself, but a handheld dog nose called Fido. One thing that interests me about this, and I was never a comic book geek as a kid, you know, and no offense to anyone in the room if you are, I mean that as a compliment deeply. But once I started learning a little bit about this suit, I couldn't help seeing a lot of compliments and a lot of popular representations of super soldiers and supermen in the popular media and in comic books. This is a Green Lantern, that was Iron Man. As any of you know who follow comic book super soldiers and superheroes, most of these, and they tend to be men, started as government scientists or in government labs. The Green Lantern was an Air Force pilot, Iron Man was a defense contractor, you have Bruce Banner who was a physicist, and became the Hulk. And then there's a lesser-known superhero that I, of course, love since doing this research, called the Atom, who can shrink himself down to the nanoscale and then expand back up again to do good deeds. And then finally, Captain America, who most of you will probably be familiar with. He was created as explicitly a super soldier to fight the Nazis, but then has fought all sorts of battles since. You could just read these really quick. But this was about his sort of creation myth, which was that he was injected with a serum in order to turn himself into the super soldier. I bring in these examples because this is what a lot of the scientists at the Institute for Soldier Institute for Soldier Nanotechnologies read. I interviewed many of them, and I wanted to know why they were drawn to this. Most people are fascinated with science, and started reading these at a really young age. And actually, the Department of Defense was very, very explicit when they sent out their initial calls for this. They wanted a battle suit that would lend the soldier of the future superhuman abilities. And that was in the official call. That was also in MIT's original press releases. This you might recognize from around town. I think this is stunning because it's so similar, actually, to the battle suit. Here's an example of their costume. Interestingly enough, when MIT first sent out the call that it had won, when the Department of Defense posts a call, they say, okay, we're inviting any large-scale research institution to answer and tell us why they deserve this $25 million in order to create the battle suit. So when MIT won the contract, they developed a press release where they needed to illustrate their version of what the soldier of the future would look like. The head of the ISN, Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology, at that time, had a 16-year-old daughter who liked to draw. And he asked her to create the mock-up for the future soldier, which I think is amazing. You've got this $25 million grant, and then you ask your daughter to draw the soldier, which is kind of lovely. Except unbeknownst to him, she was a fan of a comic strip out of Canada drawn by a brother team, Bill and Ray Lai, who created these four super soldiers. It's called Radix. And ironically, it's about a post-apocalyptic sort of view of super soldiers gone awry. They're very peace-loving comic book artists. And she copied almost exactly Valerie, this main woman. She turned her into a man and gave it back to her father. And he used it to publicize the MIT Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology, not knowing. So within about a week after MIT had sent this press release to every major media source, these comic book artists in Canada started getting really confused calls, sort of like, did you design this super soldier for MIT? And they realized it, and MIT had to make very, very public statements of apology for using the comic book art to talk about their super soldier project. So here's another image of it. It's part of a U.S. Army project called the Future Force Warrior Program. The Department of Defense describes that as a program established to create a quote, lightweight, overwhelmingly lethal, fully integrated individual combat system, including weaponry, head-to-toe individual protection, netted communication, soldier-worn power sources, and enhanced human performance. Their tagline is a formidable warrior in an invincible team. I think this is interesting. And sad, perhaps, nanotechnology really encompasses, and I'll go into briefly what that is, and perhaps plenty of you in the audience know, in which case, if you do know, you're ahead of 50% of the American people who, in a recent poll, were not able to tell you what nanotechnology was. The Department of Defense saw this type of engineering, which utilizes quirky and interesting properties of very, very small bits of matter and its engineering as the future. And I think it's because it turned our expectations of materials on their ear. It's surprising, it's deeply promissory, and I think the Department of Defense saw this as a really good primordial stew in which to evolve a super soldier. And so I'm going to show you, because I think it is a good representation of what this is. This is a little bit of propaganda from the MIT Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology. What this is a few dramatizations that they put together about pieces of the suit. I'm going to show you one which demonstrates the exomuscle. This is the same person who's developed the synthetic dog bones.
Red Cross packages to villages in the area, but even this isn't safe. This afternoon, Dewey couldn't move fast enough when we heard the incoming. We saw he hadn't made it to cover. Shrapnel, major arm wound. I didn't have to wonder long whether he was all right. Switched to monitor him. Knew they had the same picture back at command. Took his vitals, heart misbehaving, arrest. Something in that suit, the smarts to figure out what's wrong, communicate it, even do something about it, all by applying little electrical currents to systems that are unimaginably small and light. By activating tiny molecular hinges chained together by the millions in the fabric of the uniform, it was able to start CPR until help arrived. Dewey, they say he'll be just fine.
Tomorrow's soldier may have emergency medical care built right into the uniform, using a mechanically active nanomaterial dubbed exomuscle. Professor Tim Swager leads the ISN team.
We are designing at a molecular level materials that function as hinges, as levers, as materials that can change their dimension in very precise ways. And one system that we're very interested in is based on a material called a calixarane, which functions as a molecular hinge. And you can see that when I move two of the molecular components of this structure, I essentially push these other ones out and they can come back in. So imagine that we now put these into a network. We can get a situation where we can electronically access different states of the molecule and cause this to go into like an accordion mode where the molecules can either expand or contract, and we can get very large dimensional changes in these materials. And the fact that we're dealing with interactions between these two molecular components that involve chemical bonding, these forces can be very large.
Biometric monitoring, automated first medical response, a uniform that can actually give emergency treatment in those first critical seconds. ISN teams are making progress every day toward making these dreams reality.
All right, so that gives you a sense of some of the language that they use to talk about the project. If we have time, I could show you some of the other mock-ups of the suit. They had some game designers work on those mock-ups. They use them as recruiting tools to get undergraduates to do research at the Institute. In this country, it's legal as long as you are doing defense-related research. So even though this work makes the soldier more lethal, you're still able to do it in an undergraduate research environment in the United States since the 1960s. As long as it's not weapons development, people can work on it, and actually international students can work on it as well. There's some work that needs a security clearance, but not that much. So why nanotechnology to create this battle suit? Really quickly, does anyone know what nanotechnology is? You've obviously all heard the name because you're here. Anyone? I won't make you stay if you don't want to stay. I'm just curious. No one. All right. There's no physicist, chemist, ringer in the audience here? All right. Someone in the back. A nanometer, to give you a sense of scale, and this is very hard for me anyway. I was a biologist before I came to be a historian of science. A nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter or 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter. Let me give you this to sort of see. To give a sense of scale, a single grain of sand is roughly 1,000,000 nanometers wide. A virus is about 100 nanometers long. Most proteins are about 10 nanometers wide. And if you were to line up 10 hydrogen atoms end to end, that would be about 1 nanometer. Molecules of DNA are about 2 nanometers wide. You can see an E. coli bacteria is about 2,000. The nanoscale, you hear that term thrown about a bit, is the size scale that usually refers to measurements between 1 nanometer and 100 nanometers. Nanotechnology is the purposeful manipulation of matter within that size scale. And nanoscience is usually referred to the study of nano properties and nanomaterials at that same size scale. What's interesting about nanotechnology is that matter behaves differently at the nanoscale than it does at the macro scale. It was best explained to me by someone who said, imagine there's a very cute black poodle-ish dog here in the audience in the front row named Bocce. If you had a Bocce the black dog, if you continue to shrink Bocce, eventually when Bocce got to be the size of about a hamster, Bocce would turn into a lizard. It's essentially understanding matter as size dependent. Things behave very differently. A chair that's as tall as the chairs in the back is hard wood, you can stand on it. If you shrunk down that chair to be only a few nanometers wide, the chair could be soft, the chair could be purple, the chair could be reactive. It depends on the material in which you're talking about. Gold, at the size scale that we're familiar with it, like my earrings, it's somewhat soft, but it's hard enough to use in jewelry. At the nanoscale, a few nanometers worth of gold is reactive. You can use it to start reactions. It's unstable. This makes lots of different opportunities for engineering. You hear people talking about making steel that's really light, or making plastics that might conduct electricity. It opens up a large field of potential applications, and with that has come a whole lot of hype, which I'll talk about in a minute. Here's another representation of size scale. Things that we tend to see and are comfortable with in our daily life, the table, the walls, the speakers, at the nanoscale are mostly empty space. Quantum mechanics, you may, I'm sure, have all heard that term, is the study of the behavior of atoms. As I said, at the atomic scale, solid matter is mostly empty space, time is relative, mass is gained and lost as particles collide with each other. The nanoscale is slightly bigger than quantum mechanics, so it's this very interesting size scale in between where things happen and are predictable in our daily lives. When you drop an apple, it drops, it feels a certain way, steel is heavy, and the quantum scale where things are quite surprising and we still don't understand a lot of what happens at the quantum scale. So because of the quirky properties of the quantum world, the material properties of matter shift and they change at the nanoscale. And as I said, atoms behave differently in small groups than they do in large groups. And one of the things that you can do when you're making machines at the nanoscale is something that people refer to as time compression. Things tend to happen much faster because the distances that you have to travel in a nanomachine or a nanomotor are very, very small. It's the same with a battery. If the channels inside a battery are really small, you can move energy through it much more quickly. And forgive me if any of you are physicists or chemists. I had to learn a lot of this for the first time while I was learning about the emotions of dolphins. So there are, I'm sure, some gaps in my understanding of quantum mechanics. One thing that's problematic about nanotechnology, and here's a view into a nanolab, is that it's a very plastic term, and it's not very helpful, and it doesn't really mean anything. It's sort of like if we had the phrase macro technology, and that included building houses, computers, all everything that humans do. Nanotechnology really refers to any process that's happening at a very small size scale. And so you can be a chemist, and you can be doing nanotechnology. You can be a physicist. You can be a textiles manufacturer or an engineer. So really, the term should be nanotechnologies, and people should be very specific when they use it. But then it's very hard to talk about, and it's hard to distill into a soundbite. And so that's why we're left with the confusing term. Also, no one refers to themselves as a nanotechnologist. People usually, in my experience, find that offensive because it doesn't really mean anything. So they say, I'm not a nanotechnologist, I'm a biologist, or I'm a materials engineer. So that makes it even more confusing. There's nanotechnology conferences, and no one who attends them is a nanotechnologist. All right. So here's an example of scale and structure at the nanoscale. One easy to understand example of nanotechnology at work is graphene. This is a single layer of graphene or graphite in a graphite pencil. It's easiest to understand graphite if you imagine an unrolled piece of chicken wire, and that the chicken wire is about one atom thick of carbon. It's very strong side to side, but when arranged in layers, like it is inside of graphene, the layers slide off of each other. So side to side, the bonds are strong, and then in layers, they slip and slide. This is why when you use your graphite pencil and you make a mark on a piece of paper, what's actually happening is the graphite is sliding off the tip of your pencil and is staying on the paper. So the bonds between the sheets are weak, which is why you can leave graphite, but it will, the mark will be somewhat indelible unless you come by with an eraser, and I'm not sure how those work, so don't ask me. It'll stay. So how do you do nanotechnology? Nanotechnology incorporates lots of different processes. They're usually referred to as either bottom-up or top-down. An example of bottom-up nanotechnology would be anything that happens in a self-organizing fashion, which is much of nature. But really, the only thing that separates what I'm talking about is some nanotech processes and lots of things that happen, like, you know, when your cells are dividing as a fetus, is that a human is doing it purposefully. So an example is something called molecular self-assembly. One woman who's associated with the Institute for Soldier Nanotech work at MIT, her name is Angela Belcher, and she uses viruses to create batteries. So she harnesses the self-replicating power of a virus and uses that as a scaffold to make new materials that are conductive. So that's an example. You can sort of harness the power of something that's already happening in nature in order to create something new. That's often called molecular self-assembly. Or you can use DNA, the formation of strands of DNA, as tiny little ladder scaffolds in which to create a new material. An example of a top-down nanotechnology is something much like building a bridge in the macro scale. You take nanomaterials and devices, you make them by manipulating matter at the nanoscale. Usually this is done with a probe on the end of a microscope, and you push things. It's actually very low tech. It's just happening at a very small scale, and you need a really big microscope. And you push the matter into place in the shape in which you want it. Also, there's something, a way of doing lithography at the nanoscale. There's many ways, most of which I don't have time to get into. But before you do anything at the nanoscale, the most important thing was the visualization of it. It's very hard to build anything if you can't check and see what it is you're making. One way of doing this was using the scanning electron microscope. That was perhaps the biggest advance in terms of nanotechnology. This is an example of cholera bacteria seen through a scanning electron microscope. The way these work, which I think is interesting, is that you can't use your naked eye to see, obviously, anything at the nanoscale. It's too small. And all we can see, you're limited by the wavelength of light that your eye can see. And so with your human eye, you can see about 20 microns. A human hair, depending on how thick your hair is about 50 to 100 microns. So you can see about maybe a third of your hair, of one strand of your hair with your human eye. And then after that, you need help. And no light microscope was powerful enough to see nanoscale structures. So essentially, what we needed was the ability to shoot electrons at a very small structure. And by shooting the electrons and then mapping to see where those electrons fell after they bounced off of what we were trying to see through the microscope, could we then make a picture by tracking what happened to those things. It's sort of like if you were going to figure out what your friend looked like by hitting tennis balls at them and then seeing where the tennis balls fell and then reconstructing the picture of your friend. The smaller the tennis ball that you hit at your friend, the more detailed image of your friends you're going to get. So if you imagine very tiny fingers feeling something, the smaller the fingers, the more detailed the picture. That may make sense or not. I just came up with that. So let me know if that's confusing. At the nanoscales, besides the scanning electron microscope, would be the atomic force microscope. This is a very interesting microscope. It works a bit differently than the light microscope. It has a probe which works. I'll show you a picture of the probe. The probe works almost like the tip of a record player. It goes along, and when it goes over a structure, it makes a bump, and it records that on a computer, and then you get a computer-generated image of the structure. So this is an example of the tip of an atomic force microscope. Again, I'm not going to get into too many of the processes because they're huge. I'll talk to you a little bit about how the dog nose was made. But first, as soon as we started to get pictures of the nanoscale, people started to get very interested in terms of what these structures were seeing and what was going to become possible. Right about this time, Michael Crichton published the novel Prey, and I read this in about 12 minutes. We all, I'm sure, have different opinions about Michael Crichton, but it was a really fun read, I think. The premise of the novel really was that these swarms of nanorobots escaped the lab, and that they were uncontrollable, and they naturalized, and then they went after the oldest story in the book, the researchers that brought them into being. I thought it was fascinating, and I promptly brought a bunch of copies over to the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology, you guys have to read this, and they thought I was crazy. From the beginning, nanotechnology, and I'm not sure why, much more even than genetic engineering, has inspired more sort of sci-fi fears and concerns. It first became sort of known as something that we would consider nanotechnology, first mentioned in 1959. Richard Feynman gave a talk at Caltech, which has since been called More Room at the Bottom, where really he just mused that, at that point everyone was thinking about the very large and was thinking about nuclear technology. And he really was urging all of these scientists who came to his lecture to be thinking about the very small scale, and that really exciting things could happen small. And then nothing really happened about that until the 1980s. A graduate student at MIT named Eric Drexler published some work on coming nanotechnology and nanorobots, and warned, this was a little bit later, that these nanorobots might replicate out of control and eat everything in their past and slowly turn the world into a amalgamation of gray goo. There was a lot of press, and some of you guys might remember press about gray goo and whether or not that was possible and what was going to happen. He eventually recanted, but not until many years later, saying that he actually didn't believe that that was likely, but at the time that it was good science. Other things that have gotten a lot of play are nanorobots, in particular, and I don't know why these keep coming up again and again, but robots that would clean our arteries for us, that you could take a pill and the nanorobots would go through your arteries and they would slough off plaque. And wouldn't this be great? Here is another artistic representation of something that actually is maybe a little bit closer to happening, which are tumor-specific tumor killers. They would know and be able to sense the difference between tumor cells and non-tumor cells and act accordingly. Virus attackers. These are two man-made nanovirus attackers going after a virus. Two of my favorites that have ever been brought up, these would be makeup bots, and they can arrange on your face and reflect certain pigments, colors, light. I love this. And come together to fit different patterns and such. Or hair bots that would make shaving a thing of the past. You would put a few of these on your chin or on your scalp, and they would take care of things for you, which I also love. But as humans, and maybe this is something I spend too much time thinking about as a historian of science, but as humans, we're pretty bad at predicting what we're actually going to use technology for. The death laser actually never gave us a weapon of mass destruction. It actually gave us laser eye surgery and the ability to burn CDs. Or the internet, which was at least initially envisioned as a mission control system, gave us online dating, Zappos, or porn available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at any price point. Nanotechnology, I don't think it's going to be all that different. And in fact, some of the very first things we got were the world's smallest guitar, the world's smallest toilet, and then last year, Obama, like so many people, made Obama's face at the nanoscale. And then it was emailed among pretty much every lab, which is great. Nano has infiltrated manufacturing, but it hasn't caused a revolution yet. Nano-sized carbon particles have been used to strengthen tennis rackets. They're incorporated in thin films that are now sprayed on cars that are more reflective. More light that's reflected off the car keeps it cooler. You have to use less gas to use your air conditioner. Also, there's a lot of work that's been done in textiles. You can manipulate textiles at the molecular, above the molecular level, at the nanoscale level, and make them more difficult for bacteria to live inside of. This has also happened with Tupperware. Sharper Image has this whole nano silver Tupperware that's been released. And it's big business. The Woodrow Wilson International Center has a project called Project on Emerging Technologies. They're the best place, I think, and I have their website at the end if you're interested in learning more about your sunscreen or your moisturizer. They keep track of all the products because nanotechnology is really not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. And they say that as of last year, there were 800 products on the market that were utilizing nanotechnology in some way. But largely these are nano-enabled, so there's some part of the manufacturing process that's nano, but not actually the product itself. There's some exceptions, and I can talk about that if you're interested in questions. And the Lux Research Group, which is a research group that gives technology sort of prediction and investment advice, believes that by 2014, $2.6 trillion worth of manufactured goods will incorporate nanotechnology in some way. It's hard to know whether or not to take this seriously or not. It depends on a lot of things. I can tell you, though, that L'Oreal has the top patent holder for nanotechnology in the United States. And you see that often with cosmetics companies because the pressure to innovate is huge. You always want to be releasing something new. And making active ingredients very small means that you get something like a moisturizer that sinks in quickly and more easily, or a sunscreen that doesn't leave white streaks on your nose. So back to the main focus of the talk here, now that you have hopefully a little sense of the scope of nanotechnology and what it is. This is the Future Force Warrior Project. This is a man named Dutch de Gay. He works out of, or he did as of a year and a half ago, out of the Natick Soldier Center in Massachusetts. It's a partner of MIT's and the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology. And here he was at the Pentagon talking about the Future Force Warrior Project. DARPA, which is the research arm of the Department of Defense, DARPA stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has been funneling a lot of money into nanotechnology. And obviously, you know, as a civilian, I have very little access to actually what they're spending the money on. I can tell you some of what's being spent on defense, but nothing that's being spent on weapons development. DARPA's mission, though, is, quote, to create technological surprises for our adversaries. That's on their homepage. They were established as a Department of Defense agency in 1958 as America's response to the Soviet Union's launching of Sputnik. So MIT and, you know, some of my own resources that I mentioned come from DARPA, even if they've gone through the university in a few forms before they've get to me. And it's long been one of the primary ways that MIT and many other research institutions fund themselves. In the case of nanotechnology, you know, patents are only so profitable. Before you know that you have the next best tennis racket, you can't get venture capitalists to invest in your technology. So the government has a long history of stepping in this country and bringing technologies up to speed, in which point they can be sold into the private sector. So all that initial seed money usually comes from our tax dollars. It's not any different with nanotechnology. The DARPA Dog Nose Project began in 1997 with a $25 million investment. And the idea was to create an alternative to the dog nose to be used in sensing explosives. It's important to note the date. It was 1997. It was before September 11th, 2001. While they were thinking about Homeland Security, a lot of the initial responses to the Dog Nose Project were actually about mine sensing and trying to find landmines and to help countries who didn't have the resources to do that. That all changed in 2001. So while this wasn't an explicitly nanotech project, I bring it in here because the answer to it became nanotechnology. Just a brief mention about why the government wanted a synthetic dog nose. A dog's sense of smell is just an amazingly nuanced and complex thing. Any of you who own a dog or spend any time with them know that. Their nose is roughly 1,000 times more sensitive than our own. A dog has more than 220 million olfactory receptors. An olfactory receptor is a nerve cell that communicates information about scent to the brain. We only have 5 million by way of comparison. And so the moisture that you feel when you touch a dog's nose, and you know how like the old wives' wisdom was that if you touched a dog nose and it was wet, they were healthy. It's actually very true. And a wet dog nose means that they have a lot of mucus, and mucus is actually how they smell. So a molecule lodges in the mucus, and cilia inside their nose move the mucus with these molecules to the olfactory receptors that then communicate information about what's in that mucus and what's in that molecule to the brain. And the brain makes sense of it. So what's interesting about the dog, they have something that's very specialized that we don't have, which is a specialized olfactory epithelium, which is just a way of saying a very sensitive part of their nose, in their nasal cavity, and a specialized organ above the roof of the dog's mouth. It's called the vomeral nasal or the Jacobson's organ. And this is what they use to communicate information about inhaled molecules directly to a specialized region of their brain, which is called the olfactory lobe. And that stores information about their scents like a library would store files. So the variety of scents that a dog can be trained to smell is amazing. You know, they can smell buried landmines. They can smell cadavers trapped in debris. Recently, studies over the past couple years have shown they can even identify cancer long before they come up on screening tests. And what's amazing about the dog is that they can be trained so quickly to recognize a new scent, and the amount of scents they can be trained to recognize is pretty much limitless. They usually, and before 9/11, when they recognized a scent that was problematic, they would stop. And most dog handlers trained their dog to go up to a person who was not moving and would sense the person. The problem with that was that someone would know they were being sniffed. So after 9/11, there was a move to work with dogs to make their sensing seem more harder to detect. And so they started actually training the dogs to sniff moving groups of people, and lots of people. And so that a dog could stand and a group of people could move by, and without going up to every individual person, the dog would be able to tell you if it smelled explosives or drugs or anything that the dog was trained to recognize. But dogs get tired, and yeah, like this one who's sleeping now. Dogs can only work for a couple hours a day, if that, and then they get tired and they want a snack and they want to play and they need to go to the bathroom. Dogs also are covered by certain animal protection laws, even in for military use. So they can't actually be at a checkpoint all that long. And something that I found interesting in interviewing soldiers was that often the dogs had more protections than the soldiers did. So the soldier could be there, you know, 18 hours, but the dog could only be there 4. And so that presented some challenges. They're also expensive. Since 9/11, the cost of a bomb-trained dog, sniffing dog, has also gone up. The cost of a German Shepherd, a well-trained German Shepherd, is about $10,000. And a dog and canine handler team out of a contract service, and this was a couple years ago, was $100 an hour. So the costs add up pretty quickly. So DARPA looked at this and they were like, we need a dog nose. And Tim Swager, the man in the video with the exomuscle that I showed you guys at the beginning of the talk, was someone who saw that call and decided to answer it. He's from a small town. This is Sheridan, Wyoming. Sheridan, Montana. He was dyslexic as a boy. He wasn't necessarily a very good student. He bagged groceries. His father was a country doctor. And he wasn't at all a very good student. He actually flunked out of his first year of college. And then something happened, and he decided he was interested in chemistry. He went back to school, and he became a straight-A chemistry student. And I think what happened was that he realized he had an aptitude for imagining 3D molecules in his mind. He was dyslexic, he had problems with language, but he had an uncanny ability to imagine a molecular structure and also to creatively imagine molecular structure in that he could imagine new molecules and then he could create them in the lab. He constantly is drawing molecules on the backs of things, on the backs of napkins, on people's tenure applications. I've seen that in his office. So from this initial rocky start, he went on, he was a superstar at Caltech, and now he's the head of chemistry at MIT. By his 47th birthday, which was, I think, last year or the year before, he had 29 patents. He'd published over 300 scientific papers. He advises roughly 18 graduate students. His lab has an operating yearly budget of $20 million. And in 1998, he created something that really was going to change the landscape of photochemistry, which is the understanding of the branch of chemistry that looks at the effect of light on chemical systems. So what he did was that he worked with one of his graduate students named Ji Shan and made something called the G polymer. And this polymer is called pentaptycene. It's really interesting. And it really did change the landscape of photochemistry, and I'll tell you why. But at the time he made this, and when he actually responded to DARPA's call to create the synthetic dog nose, he was thinking about landmines along with many other folks. These are some landmines from Cambodia. And these are some American soldiers actually not placing them but removing them. This is Tim in his lab at MIT. So this was the late 90s. He was thinking about how these sensors could work for landmines. Landmines present an interesting challenge for dogs, even though that they can smell them. Obviously, the dog usually has to be so close to the landmine that you're putting the dog at risk, and the dog works at a handler with a handler, so you're putting the human handler at risk too. So there is a need for a good landmine detection technology that's also cheap and replicable and can be sent around the world. Tim was traveling on 9/11. He was at London Heathrow, headed back to Boston. He saw the attacks on the Twin Towers, and he said that he realized his life was about to change while he was watching this video footage. He immediately knew that these sensors could be used for homeland security applications. And sure enough, right after 9/11, there was money flooding into his laboratory to think about how these sensors that lit up detected explosives could be used to detect explosives to screen either entrance to the United States or anyone else who was a person of question. So a little bit, just really quickly, about his sensor is that it's a polymer. Really, before I did this, the only thing I knew about polymers was that they were plastic. The word polymer appeared in 1866 in an English chemistry text on a type of acid. It probably comes from the Greek word polymeres, which means consisting of many parts. That's exactly what a polymer is. It's any large molecule that's built from a chain of smaller repeating units. So this is an example. Each one of these is exactly the same, and they're together in a line. That's really all that a polymer means. The first synthetic polymers were created in the first half of the 20th century. 1907, Leo Baekeland made, he was a Belgian-born American chemist, and he made Bakelite. And he combined phenol, which is a white crystalline compound derived from benzene, which is why Bakelite can be toxic, and formaldehyde. And he exposed it to high heat and pressure, and then we got very fashionable fork holders and jewelry. In 1935, a DuPont chemist named Wallace Carruthers and his team of researchers created nylon, another synthetic polymer. By the time the U.S. entered World War II, DuPont's nylon factories were not only mass-producing women's stockings, but they were using the fiber for parachutes and B-29 bomber tires. This is an example of a natural polymer, which is the rubber tree. These are some synthetic polymers. As we now know, we live in a sea of synthetic polymers. And manufactured synthetic polymers, margarine containers, pink flamingos, yard decorations, acrylic nails. But polymers are not just plastics. And some that show little or no ability to stretch, like cellulose, a plant material, can be woven together to create materials like cotton clothing. Kevlar is another form of a non-plastic polymer. So the polymer that Tim developed, which is right here, it's this yellow fluorescing bit called pentaptycene, had been sitting sort of quietly in the back of his mind for a long time, and he hadn't tried making it until this graduate student came along. His hope was that it would emit fluorescent light that could be used to indicate whether or not molecules of explosives were present in the air. And as I said, as he initially thought that they could be used to sense explosives in terms of landmines, he quickly realized that they would be very well suited to detect bomb-making ingredients or traces of people who had been working on bombs. So they tried it a bunch of times in the laboratory, and they finally synthesized this, which is this fluorescing polymer. And when it's a solid, it glows really bright yellow. When it's a fluid, it glows blue. And all you need is one molecule of TNT passing close by this, and it actually, the light will go out. So it's called quenching, which is this process. This has long been used to detect explosives. This was nothing new. What Tim did that was so groundbreaking was that he put these pentaptycene polymers together in long chains, and it resulted in something called amplification. And so all you needed was one molecule of TNT and then like a row of Christmas lights, all the other lights in the string would go out. And so what would happen before was that you would have one molecule of TNT bind to a sensitive polymer, and yes, you would have one sort of molecule that would go out, but in a large, like a solid that's big enough to see, you would have no idea of the change in light. You couldn't sense that with the human eye. And so what he created was a kind of instantaneous reaction that would dim everything at once. And he hooked that up to a handheld sensor. And this essentially is a dog nose. I realize it looks nothing like it. But it does sniff. So inside of this handheld thing that looks slightly like a gun is a glass tube. And the glass tube is coated with this very sensitive polymer. And there's a little vacuum here. You can see this is an air intake. And so what happens is that when you turn it on, air is sucked through the tube. And as long as you hold the end near anything that could have even a molecule of TNT on it, it will adhere to the side of the tube and the light will go out. You don't see the light, but what you do see is you have this handheld sensor, and you can either look at it, or if you're not worried about being observed, you can turn the sound on, and it sounds just like a Geiger counter, if you've ever heard a Geiger counter, but it's sort of like click, 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 if it gets something. And these are being used all over the place now. You can also think of it sort of as fly paper. You know, if one fly stick to the paper, all the paper fell off the wall. This is essentially a very simplified version of what's going on here. And this is some of the applications it's been used for. It's been field tested at checkpoints in Iraq and Afghanistan for a number of years. It's also being put on robots to sense and look and locate IEDs. And then this is something called PhytoFastGate. This is a new application of it here. And this is so that you can observe people without them knowing, because if you have been working on a bomb or you have been working on a chemical, they're also trying to use Phyto now to get to identify not only explosives but other things. If you've been working on any of these different materials, you've probably touched your ID, and so this is kind of a covert way. They then sense what's on your ID, what's been on your fingers transferred to your ID. So this would be like part of your security to enter your building. They're selling it that way. So you unknowingly put your ID into the ID recognition slot, and it's sensing all of the potential explosives you've been in contact with. This is called the Phyto Verdict. I don't know how they come up with these names, but they're apt. This is the palm-sized explosives and narcotics identifier. The Homeland Security Agency just last year gave the company that Tim sold this to and that he is a large part of, Nomadics, a $1 million grant to help figure out how to use this in ports. It's very hard to search boats, and you've probably seen some of this in the press. It's very hard to search lots of boats in a harbor. It takes a long time with a dog. Same with an airport, although I've read that a dog can actually search an entire airport in 2 hours, which is amazing. But the Phyto Verdict, they hope, will be even faster. And they're using this in all over the place. So the Phyto is at many different airports. I don't actually have access to what airports. That's not something they want people to know. And also, what can confuse the Phyto? Dogs can be confused by things like toner cartridges in printers. They smell chemical. It makes sense. So Phyto, it can also be tripped up. Obviously, they don't want people to know what trips Phyto up, and they won't tell me that. So another thing that FIDO has been used for, and I don't have a picture of this, is they developed something called the Sea Pup, which is a version of FIDO that's underwater and that can be deployed to sense explosives dissolved in water. That the handheld thing actually can be used to do that too. And that's one advantage over the dog. The problem, and this is a U.S. Coast Guard inspector with a dog, is that dogs are still much better than FIDO. And there's been trial after trial, and one of them that I love, and this is an early one, is that they went to a big field and they buried a lot of explosives or things that had markers like explosives, and they let out the dog and they let out the FIDO, and the person with the FIDO ran around and the dog ran around, and then they tried to figure out who was faster and better at figuring out what was where the explosive was or not. The thing is that FIDO is much more specific. It only needs about a molecule. You know, when you see a dog smell and they're sort of going like, and oh my God! That was amazing. Okay, so they do that. They're filling their nasal cavity with a bunch of molecules to try and figure it out. So they do all those little sniffs, and then they really do the big sniff, and they need a bunch of molecules to figure out what it is that they're smelling. The FIDO only needs one molecule, so it's just kind of like this steady machine-powered sniff. So it's much more sensitive. The problem is that FIDOs, and at least the first generations of them, were made to detect individual explosives. You couldn't make a FIDO that could detect as many things that a dog could detect. Also, FIDOs don't have judgment. They're not empathetic. They don't have senses of humor. They can't make judgment calls. They don't know to read the language of the handler. There's so many complex aspects of the relationship between handler and dog that the FIDO's missing that makes the handler just as good at sensing the explosives as the dog that they're working with. So FIDO has not been as successful as it could be, and is not trainable. So every time you needed to sense a new explosive, and believe me, people are making up new explosives all the time, is that you had to go back to the drawing board and build a new sensor. The dog just needs a week and can be trained on whatever new explosive or biological weapon that someone has come up with. Unfortunately, this has not stopped DARPA from trying to create and ask for a new dog nose, except this time they want something called a real nose. This just boggles my mind. After spending so much money on the dog nose project and coming up with, yes, a chemical sensor that's being used at airports, and the FIDO is very portable and it's pretty cheap as chemical sensors go, and it is sensitive. Rather than train more dogs, there is still a large interest on behalf of the Department of Defense in coming up with a fake nose. Except this time, they don't want a chemical sensor. They realize that that's wrongheaded. They want a nose, and they want olfactory cells. And there is a team at MIT who has come up with a way of creating these cells in the lab and has created something of a synthetic mucus. And I don't know as much about this. It's just really beginning, and I have been working on other research. So I can't give you as much information as I'd like to about the MIT Real Nose, although there's a lot of information online, and if you're interested, I can tell you where to go. They won a grant from the DOD as part of this Real Nose project, and they're trying to create an actual portable mammalian nose. And what they're doing is trying to get it to recognize patterns, which is how we recognize smells and how dogs recognize smells. You know, they sense a few molecules and then they compare it to other things that they've sensed and recognized in the past. This is how we recognize smells that we know or that we don't know. And what these MIT scientists are hoping to do is do the very same thing. To sort of bring this back to the Super Soldier project, I think it's interesting that this the synthetic dog nose that's been the first thing to really be spun out of this. We could talk about why, and if you're curious, I can tell you what other parts of the suit have come along faster than other parts. I don't honestly know that we will ever get a battle suit of the future. I think that this might have been a really large sort of a campaign to get support for the individual soldier, as opposed to, you know, UAVs or unmanned vehicles as a way of fighting wars. I think this happened at the tail end of, you know, or it began, I guess, in the beginning of what was going on in Iraq. And we began to realize that battles were still being fought person to person. And what does this mean? But I think the idea of creating a future soldier project is largely banking on the idea of a future insurgent and a future someone to fight. And I think, you know, we could talk more about that. I also think it's interesting that they were so explicit in a very unembarrassed fashion about the links to superheroes and comic book heroes. And the idea that, you know, we could, not unlike, you know, giving Spider-Man, who has the ability to spin webs, you know, or Batman, who can fly like a bat, or Catwoman, who's like a cat. I mean, superheroes who have animal powers are a dime a dozen. You know, is it surprising that the first element of this future soldier project is the ability, or the hopeful unplanned ability, to smell explosives as well as a dog? I don't know. I'm interested in these overlaps between the science fiction, the comic book, and the very real and Department of Defense. The word hero is of Greek and Latin origin. The OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, defines it as, quote, a name given, as in Homer, to men of superhuman strength, courage, or ability favored by the gods, at a later time regarded as intermediate between gods and men and immortal. The word first appeared in the English language in the 14th century, and by the 16th, it was closely tied to the conception of a warrior. Heroism was now primarily heroic in the context of war. I think that within the Department of Defense, a dance of innovation, improvement, a gospel of progress and efficiency makes the American soldier a reflection of his or her times in very similar ways that our imagination of superheroes makes the superhero a reflection of collective sort of social desires, and is an interesting sort of mirror. And so I think that just as the rules of physics and believability that are suspended, you know, to allow Spider-Man to cling to buildings or Iron Man to shoot through the sky, also happened within the Department of Defense. And the rules of believability are often suspended to usher in new conceptions of what it means to be an individual soldier. So thank you. Amazing. Sure. I guess I could stand up. Yeah.
Why do you think nanotechnology has taken on this kind of, like when you show these pictures, it's always a kind of a little metal machine that's battling little organic blobs.
Yeah.
But nanotechnology seems really to be sort of, it's chemistry in a lot of ways. It is organic in the way that you put it together. It's rarely, I think anyway, it's rarely little robot shiny things, right?
Yeah.
They work more like viruses than they do like, you know, bulldozers.
Yeah.
What's the social, I mean, why is that?
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you. I think that it's more fun to represent, honestly. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to make a chemical reaction sexy in the same way that, you know, a nanorobot that cleans your arteries is, you know, even though that's much more accessible. And I think the elements of the nanotech sort of landscape that have been so promissory are those that have been these nanorobots and the nanodevices. And there are some nanodevices that people are working on, and, you know, the batteries are interesting and are everywhere, and semiconductors. And so those are within the realm of possibility, and they're already in many of our manufacturing processes, but I don't think they're as fun. You know, and so, but.
So it's just a PR thing?
Or? I don't know. Well, a lot of this, like the artists who did this, they're scientists, you know, who I showed you those paintings and drawings are. It wasn't, you know, media sources. I mean, these are the scientists, you know, and I think it's sort of what brought them to it, and, you know, what is interesting for them to think about, and what is not possible yet, perhaps also. You know, it's sort of this dream of a future. Yeah.
I wonder if you're familiar with the technology that NYPD is using. If anyone here has been like the subway, they take like a little white cloth and they rub it on your bag. And it's sort of like Fido light, but probably not as fancy.
Yes, it's less expensive. I know that. No, I don't. I know that it operates very differently, and that's what the airports and Homeland Security Agency is trying to avoid, because it doesn't work very well at all. Because as you can imagine, you have to go up to something, the person knows they're being searched or sensed, and you have to touch it to figure it out. So in terms of, you know, this sort of like society-wide surveillance that has been the theme of late, it doesn't work very well. And there's a high error percentage. Most of what happens at the airport doesn't work at all, and that's what the Homeland Security Agency doesn't want you to know. Those like booths where you go in and you're blasted with air, I don't know if you guys have ever been in those don't work at all. They have huge error rates, and they charged a fortune, and we paid for that as taxpayers. Yeah.
So you're playing havoc with my romantic idea of science fiction being the harbinger of what will happen. Now I pull out my iPhone and I see Dick Tracy, not that I remember Dick Tracy. But it seems as when we're changing scales now, our romantic idea can't follow the diminution of objects because we're kind of macro scale in our imagination. So are we done with that kind of correlation between our science fiction and the future?
And the future? Well, I might disagree with you. I think that science has always looked to science fiction. You know, I think that there is just, that border is much more porous than we like to think, or than we tend to think. I mean, I don't know that there was a golden age where, science fiction was the future and or not. I mean, I think that we've always looked backwards and forwards, or if not backwards and forwards, I think we've always looked to literature to inspire science, and much of the science fiction literature has looked to science. So, I mean, I think, and an example of that would be Prey. Every Michael Crichton's novel, every nanotechnology conference I've been to, even the one sponsored by like the Environmental Protection Agency, one of the first slides in almost everyone's presentation is Michael Crichton's cover. You know, this is amazing that his novel actually is what is spurring so many discussions, even at like the regulation level in this country. And then it was science fiction, and it's this fear of nanobots that is getting people to talk about, you know, nano silver in the water or nano titanium in our sunscreen. And I think he did that as a fiction writer, you know, but he only did it because he was, you know, he read this stuff voraciously. And he only wrote that book because he was reading about what was coming out in science. So, I mean, I think